I want to thank all of those of you who helped out over at Lake Avenue this morning. A few of you have made it back here. Most of them are still over there helping out. But it was great to have such a large contingent, and we had quite a crowd there, so we really did need all of you there. So thank you for helping out over there. And it was interesting just talking to people before the event took place. They're asking what I was going to speak about, and again, it confirms what I was sharing there over at Lake Avenue, that most Christians simply are not aware of the best evidences scientifically for the Christian faith and for biblical inerrancy. So I think it does meet a need there. Well, last week I was sharing with you about three different sets of publications, how in the scientific literature in the month of December, they were basically commenting on the fact that we're seeing way too much design. And is there some way of looking at our system in a way where we don't have all this design? They're really referring to the solar system. When we look at our system of planets, it seems way too designed. As we look at our system of asteroid belts, again, way too much design. And as we look at the moon, way too much design. And so a number of papers have been published where they've been trying to say, is there some way we can get beyond all this evidence for design and come up with a simpler explanation where we don't have to invoke the supernatural? And the bottom line is all three sets of these studies, we're talking literally dozens of research papers, are concluding, no, we really are stuck with this level of design. In fact, there's more design than what we thought was there in the first place. So last week we talked about the planets. What I want to talk about a little bit this week before we jump into our lesson are the asteroids. And when you went to school, you're probably taught about the asteroids, but you're probably taught about the smallest of the asteroid belts. It's actually called the main belt. But let me bring this up here. Let's see if we can... Here we go. Okay. There are literally five asteroid and comet belts that orbit about our solar system. And the one they call the main belt is the one that orbits between Mars and Jupiter. And if you talk to most lay people, they think that's the sum total of all the asteroids and comets. Really, it's the smallest of our asteroid belts. And then we have what are called the centaurs. The centaurs are an asteroid belt that exists between Jupiter and Neptune. And one reason why the main belt gets so much attention, they're the closest to us. So they're easier to see. But now we've got the telescope power to see the ones between Jupiter and Neptune. And then there's another group called the scattered belt. And that's between Uranus and about 20 billion miles out. Now, to give you some idea, Neptune orbits about 4 billion miles out from the Sun. So when we say Uranus to 20 billion, that's about 3 billion miles, or 2.5 billion actually, out to about 20 billion. And then what's really caught people's attention is something called the Kuiper Belt. That's a really big belt of asteroids and comets. They exist from Neptune all the way out to about 6 billion miles. And so they're actually closer to us than many of the scattered belt asteroids and comets. But the biggest asteroid belt of all is what we call the Oort cloud. And that exists from 10 billion miles out to 2 trillion miles out. So we actually have a gigantic belt. Oh, thank you.
An engineer requests to fix something, I'm sorry.
And engineers, we have to fix things, don't we?
I didn't even notice, so thank you for taking care of that. That's still a little bit off, so. All right. I'll just read it off to you. But I just need to move it over a little bit more, I think, or maybe the focus. You know, you need to move it. Yeah. But yeah, the thing about the Oort cloud is it actually extends halfway out to the nearest star. So, and it's by far the biggest of the asteroid and comet belts, yes. Well, there's kind of a gradation. I mean, at one extreme, you've got what are called the stainless steel asteroids. And so these are asteroids that are basically pure stainless steel. iron, cobalt, nickel, and nothing else. And maybe a few scattered heavy elements. But it's actually a better grade of stainless steel than what you can buy in the open market. And so, for example, Eskimos living thousands of years ago would wander throughout the Canadian tundra and look for rocks, because they would, you know, basically find these pieces of stainless steel asteroids, and that's what they made their knives out of. They would actually, you know, because, you know, here you got stainless steel right away. And so some of you might have this kitchen tool. It's actually an Eskimo tool, which is just basically a single blade that's curved, and you use it to cut stuff. I forget what they call it. There's some special technical name for it. And, you know, they put a piece of wood on one end, but they actually use it as a slicing tool. And they used to make those out of asteroids. So if you live in a snowy area and you see a rock on the snow, chances are if it's fresh snow, it must have come from outer space. So they would actually go out and look for these things. Okay, that's one extreme. The other extreme are what we call comets, which are basically frozen liquids. And so your typical comet is 80% frozen water, and the other 15 to 20% are other frozen gases, like frozen methane, frozen ammonia. So gases that normally would be gas at our temperature, but given how far away they are. And so, for example, as you move from the main belt out to the Oort cloud, the percentage of comets goes up. And so the Oort cloud is dominated by comets and only a few asteroids, whereas the main belt, because it's closer to the sun, where, you know, they have all these frozen gases, they get close enough to the sun that the stuff evaporates, and evaporates, it's gone. So in the main belt, we have lots of asteroids. But not all the asteroids are stainless steel. Only about 25% of what we call the rocky stuff that's out there would be stainless steel. The other 75% is basically rocky material like you would see in the crust of the Earth. And some of it is very rich in carbon, often much richer in carbon than we see in the crust of the Earth. And it's something that we notice is that planet Earth is extremely carbon poor. So it's really no surprise that these primitive... And basically what comets and asteroids are, they're leftover debris from the planet-building history of our solar system. So they're considered to be the oldest objects in our solar system, and basically show you what the solar system was like before planets began to form. And what we notice, for example, is that the quantity of carbon is much higher. And so we call these carbonaceous meteorites or carbonaceous asteroids. And they actually dominate the stainless steel ones. Yes?
The way you have those described, the last four appear to all overlap.
They do overlap. And I was going to get into that. Okay. The scattered belt has the property that they're scattered. So scattered asteroids and comets probably were members of the Centaurs or the Kuiper belt or the Oort cloud, but they got scattered by the dynamics of the gas giant planets. And so where the scattered belt ones stand out, they have extremely high inclinations and very eccentric orbits, which is a symptom that they've been gravitationally scattered. Because your typical comet or asteroid orbits about the solar system in the plane of the solar system. But the scattered belt ones, instead of orbiting the plane, they orbit like this or like that. And again, they have very eccentric orbits. Whereas the Kuiper belt tend to have more circular orbits, and that's what distinguishes the Kuiper belt from the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud comets and asteroids have very eccentric orbits. Some of them can have inclinations, but the Kuiper belt ones all seem to be densely clumped together. I mean, Neptune, for example, is 4 billion miles out. So the Kuiper belt is only 2 billion miles wide. And it's a very dense belt of asteroids and comets, but their orbital features are different from the scattered belt and the Oort cloud. And then the Centaurs are in between Jupiter and Neptune. So that kind of gives you a feel of what they're all like. But by studying these asteroid belts, these five different belts, it gives us insight into the history of how our planets formed. So last week I talked about just how amazingly designed our solar system planets are. It's because of research on asteroids and comets we know why our planets are so special compared to planets we see orbiting other systems. There was a hand here and then there was a hand back there. Yes?
Well, I think you kind of answered that, but basically all the asteroids and comets are on a planar plane like the ring of Saturn. They're in a thin ring or they disperse in a sphere around our solar system.
The word cloud tends to be more spherical than it is a plane. The Kuiper belt tends to be a plane. The scattered belt tends to be scattered every which way. So, but yeah, the Oort cloud is far enough out. In fact, the more distant Oort cloud ones tend to have more of a spherical distribution. That's why we refer to the centaurs, notice we call them belts, main belt, scattered belt, Kuiper belt, which means they tend to be in a plane. Cloud means they're not in a plane, they tend to be spherically distributed. And likewise, a scattered belt would be more like the Oort cloud. Yes?
If an asteroid or a comet was to collide with Earth and, I guess, annihilate everything, how much notice do you think? How long would it, if a scientist looks in the sky, how long would it take? Would it be...
Well, that's the good news, is that, if you were to ask me that question 10 years ago, I'd say, well, you might have a day or two. But thanks to NASA realizing that the risk of collisions from asteroids and comets is not trivial. And what they mean by that, we actually pay insurance money for risks that are a lot more remote than the risk of getting a damage claim from an asteroid or a comet. And so they're saying, hey, we need to give this some attention. Now I think they could give you a warning of a few months as opposed to a few days. But their goal is to be able to give you a warning of a few years.
And how would you, is there any way of protecting yourself or the Earth? Or how would you?
Well, if you're going to get hit by something really big, there's not much you can do about it. But those are rare. I mean, as I'll explain in a few minutes, ones that are going to be threatening to advanced life only happen about every 25 million years. But you could get one that could wipe out Manhattan, for example, and those are much more frequent. Manhattan destroying events happen about every 10,000 years. And one reason why NASA is interested in this is that potentially we have the technology that we could avoid a Manhattan destroying event. In other words, if we got several months' notice that this is going to take place, we could actually send up spacecraft to divert the asteroid or the comet away from an Earth collision path. So as long as it's not too big, we can do something about it. And so that's one reason why this research is now taking place.
Well, just one other real quick question. The comets, what is exactly, how did the oceans inform? Was the comets that would drop off the water or how?
Well, that's exactly what this flood of research papers is telling us. We need comet and asteroid collisions if we want advanced life. And so, but we don't want too many. having a Manhattan event every few hours would not be a good thing. But for that very reason, is we now realize that the water we have got here through comets.
All the water is all from...
Virtually, because, the latest... planet formation models tell us that if a planet forms interior to the snow line, it will be bone dry. And, rocky planets would have to form, interior to the snow line. And so what brings the water to them? Comets.
That's an awful lot of comets.
Well, we were getting hit a lot more frequently in the past than we are today. So... the cometary collision rate has dropped significantly. I mean, that again is testimony to God's plan. He put us human beings here late, because if he put us here early, we'd be bombarded too much.
Well, how much water does it deposit? A puddle? A pond? A lake? I mean, how would one comet actually...
Well, it depends on the size of the comet. I mean, and keep in mind that a comet is about 80 to 85% frozen water. So if you get a big one colliding with the Earth, it delivers a lot of water. Say, how big can they get? Well, they can get as big as 500 miles across. Chances are we didn't get hit by anything that big, but we do know we've gotten hit by plenty of comets that were 10 miles in diameter. And a 10-mile diameter comet that's 80% frozen water delivers a lot of water. Yes, I think you're first. Go ahead, in the back.
Yeah, the comet looks like it's falling apart with that long tail. Was it one piece because it never goes out? You know, it was here before. It's still the same.
The reason why you see a tail on a comet is that when it gets close to the sun, the heat of the sun begins to evaporate the ice. And so a comet far away looks like just a nice spherical ball, if it's big. But as it approaches the sun, then a lot of the ice begins to evaporate. In fact, this comet Ison, that was predicted to be the comet of the century, well, it's predicted to be the comet of the century if it survived going around the sun. It did not do too well going around the sun. And so there's very little of it left. And therefore, we're not anticipating that Ison's going to be very spectacular. You can see it in the sky, but with great difficulty. But if it had managed to get around the sun without too much of its frozen gases being evaporated, it would have been the brightest object in the sky except for the sun and the moon. And some were even predicting it would be visible in the daytime. But as it went around the sun, it got beat up pretty badly. Most of its ice got evaporated, so it's just a shadow of its former self. But that's why you see a tail. That tail is basically evaporated ices off the comet. Yes?
A couple of questions. Oort cloud is pretty thick, and then you say it's spherical around the solar system. Do they know that because they've observed it, or is it because of the inclination of the comet coming in? And the second question is, do we find those around other exoplanet solar systems?
Yep, and getting to all that. That's what's all in these research papers. And there was a time when, for example, younger creationists were saying, the Kuiper Belt doesn't exist. The Oort cloud doesn't exist. We've never seen any Kuiper Belt objects or Oort cloud objects. But Kuiper and Oort were astronomers in the mid part of the 20th century. And they were the ones who analyzed the physics of our solar system and said there must be a belt beyond Neptune that goes out about 6 billion miles, and there must be an Oort cloud in order to explain the short-period comets that we see and also to explain the structure of our solar system. Even though they hadn't seen any, they said this must be the way it is. Our theory demands it. Well, now we've actually got the telescope power to see Kuiper Belt objects and to see Oort cloud objects. So now we can't see the ones that are 2 trillion miles out, but we are able to see the ones that are, say, 30 billion miles out. The bigger ones are visible. And we now have been able to see enough of them to realize that the Oort cloud is not quite like what Jans Oort, Dutch astronomer, thought it was. He thought it was basically a spherical distribution of comets and asteroids. We now know it's more complex, that there's an interior disk-like distribution of Oort cloud objects surrounded by a much bigger spherically distributed cloud of comets and asteroids. But we do know that Oort was right, that it goes out halfway to the nearest star.
Which would make it even more difficult for aliens to make their way there.
Well, and to answer your question, are we seeing these things around other stars? Again, even 5 years ago, I'd have to say, we don't know. Today, we've got the telescope power for actually finding these clouds and belts around other stars. But the vast majority don't have them. Only a few have them. And the few that have them have way bigger ones than ours. And that's kind of where I'm going with this thing, that our asteroid and comet belts are unique to our sun. We're not seeing this anywhere else. 95% of all the stars we look at that are, quote, solar-like don't have these asteroids and comet belts. And we now know why they don't have them. I'll get to that in a minute. And the rest of them do have belts, but they're like 100 to 1,000 times bigger than ours. And both of those scenarios would rule out the possibility of life. In order to have life, these asteroid and comet belts have to be extraordinarily fine-tuned. And that's kind of where this is going. Until a month ago, they thought, well, it looks very fine-tuned, but now they're saying it's much more fine-tuned than what we thought. And it really does look like there's something extraordinarily special and uniquely designed about our solar system, and that's why we're here and why we're not going to find advanced life anywhere else. Yes, Susan.
Can you explain what interior with no line means?
Okay. Yeah, I mentioned that briefly last week, but let me mention it again. And it's crucial to whether or not you get asteroids and comets. The snow line is that distance from the star where these gases will remain in a frozen state. And so it's that minimum distance from the sun where you can have ammonia, methane, and water remain permanently frozen. And in the case of our solar system, that's about 40 to 50 million miles interior to the orbit of Jupiter. Now, for a gas giant planet to form, it must form outside the snow line. The only way you're going to get a big planet with lots of frozen gases is if it forms beyond the snow line. Now, in order to get asteroids and comets, it's important that you have a big gas giant planet intact just beyond the snow line. And see, that's one of the features of Jupiter. It's just a little bit further out from the sun than the snow line. And that's what makes possible the formation of these asteroids and comets. So if the gas giant planet is too far away from the snow line, it's not going to happen. And if it's interior, it's not going to happen. Now, the interesting thing is, we've now found about 1,100 planets outside of our solar system. And most of the ones we've found are gas giants. They're the easiest ones to see. But 94% of the gas giant planets that we do see orbiting other stars are interior to the snow line. And this wasn't known until they discovered planets outside of our solar system. The feeling was, well, other planetary systems will be like ours. And they were rather shocked to discover all these gas giants are orbiting rather close to their stars. And I mean, really close. Like around the orbit of Venus and Mercury and even interior. Now, it's been well understood for about 40 years how gas giant planets form. They have to form beyond the snow line. Why do we see so many interior to the snow line? Because they migrate. They form beyond the snow line, but they migrate inward close to their star. And that's what stimulated a number of theoreticians back in the late 1990s to say, let's figure out how it is they're able to migrate. Well, how they're able to migrate is that here's a gas giant that forms outside the snow line, but surrounding it are a lot of asteroids and comets, what they call planetesimals, asteroids and comets. And these theoreticians noted that if there's plenty of these objects around the gas giant, the gravitational interaction of the gas giant with the planetesimals, the asteroids, and the comets generates migration. So it explains why you get that migration. But the big mystery is, why no or very little migration for Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune? And that's kind of where these latest research papers have gone, trying to answer the question why they did migrate, but only a little. And why we're not seeing that on other planetary systems. Now, there's a question here. Yes.
So you have these comets and asteroids just outside the orbit of a gas giant. Couldn't one argue, well, the mass of these things would then pull it outward rather than repel inward? So what's the explanation?
Well, there's two kinds of migration you can get. There's outward migration and inward migration. And depending on the population of the planetesimals and the asteroids and the comets and where the gas giants form, you either get outward migration or inward migration. Now, I mentioned that 94% of the gas giants we see are orbiting considerably interior to the snow line. What about the other 6%? The other 6% are orbiting way far away from their star. Again, it's revealing something unique about our solar system. The gas giants are pretty well stuck a little bit beyond the snow line. We don't see that elsewhere. Well, we see a couple, but of the 1,000+, it's really just a handful that are orbiting the approximate distance that Jupiter and Saturn orbit. And those that we do see orbiting there have partner planets that orbit interior. So this is again where our solar system sticks out like a sore thumb. We have no gas giants orbiting interior to Jupiter's orbit, none inside the snow line, and the ones that are outside the snow line, none of them are very far away. We don't see that anywhere else. And that's kind of where these research papers are pointing out. It seems like the migration in our solar system was extraordinarily fine-tuned to make life possible. That's kind of where it's coming out. I'll give you a direct quote. This is in a paper by Martin and Livio. And they say, a small amount of migration is needed to remove a large enough fraction of asteroids and comets. So if you don't get a little bit of migration, you wind up with a huge amount of asteroids and comets. And we see that around a few other stars. Yes, they got asteroids and comets, but they got hundreds to thousands of times more than what we have. And they said, to get rid of that huge population, you need a small amount of migration. But if you got too much migration, you get rid of them all. And so that's kind of the typical picture. We look at a planet that's got a star with planets. There are no asteroids and comets. They got rid of everything. And that means that your rocky planets will be bone dry. They will not have water because the migration eliminated all the asteroids and comets, and therefore there's no water delivery. And since the rocky planets form interior to the snow line, there will not be the supply of liquids because interior to the snow line, those things are going to be in a gaseous form if they're out there in the interplanetary medium. So something is necessary to bring that liquid water in. And the mechanism is you get comets colliding with a planet, and those comets have frozen water, and when they collide with a planet, the frozen water becomes liquid. But because the planet's got a big enough size to it, it retains the liquid water. It also explains why Mercury and Venus and Mars are bone dry. In the sense that, yes, they get comets delivering them, but because they're not as big as the Earth, their gravity is not adequate to retain the water. And so Mercury is bone dry, Venus is bone dry, and so is Mars, with two exceptions. We do think there's a small region on Mercury where we're going to find some frozen water, but it's a place where the sun never shines. Just like we think that there's a place on the moon. Sorry, that was completely unintentional. Yeah, now I know where the class is thinking.
I enjoyed it.
For example, NASA is thinking we might be able to actually have a permanent colony on Moon if we send astronauts up there with the appropriate equipment to a crater at the south pole of the Moon. And it's a crater with walls so high that the sun never makes it to the floor of the crater. And therefore, as comets bring water into that crater, it remains in a frozen state. Now, because the Moon is partnered with the Earth, its rotation axis is quite stable. Just like the Moon stabilizes our rotation axis, the Earth stabilizes the rotation axis of the Moon. And therefore, that frozen water remains. Now, you say, well, isn't there water on Mars? Yes, there's frozen water on Mars. That frozen water is there because of ongoing comet delivery. So, just like the Earth receives water from comets on an ongoing basis, so does Mars. But unlike Mercury and Venus, Mars is far enough away from the Sun where there's certain places on Mars where the frozen water remains frozen. That explains the polar caps. But notice on Mars, the polar caps don't have much ice. Just a very thin layer of frozen carbon dioxide and frozen water. Why? Because Mars does not have a moon to stabilize its rotation axis tilt. So over the course of tens of millions of years, its rotation axis does this, flips back and forth. And you just heard earlier that where the rover is warmer than Winnipeg. Not surprising. I've been to Winnipeg in winter a few times, and it can get really cold. So I can tell you one funny story. I was doing some TV work up in Winnipeg, and they said, well, when you get off the plane, just get out your cell phone and call us, and we'll come by with our car and pick you up. So I got out of the airport, picked up my cell phone, and my hand immediately froze, and I said, this isn't going to work. So I went inside the airport and tried to call, but I couldn't get phone reception. So now I had a problem. How am I going to make a call for the ride if I can't do it in a warm place and I go outside? So I had my gloves. But you know how difficult it is trying to make a phone call with thick mitts on your... gloves don't work. It's too cold for gloves. You got to have mitts. So I was kind of using my thumb to try to make the phone call. And then a native Winnipeg resident came up to me and says, here, I'll show you how to do it. He grabbed my phone. He had a big mitt, and he says, I'm practiced at this. And he gave the phone number for me. Say, how cold was it? Well, it was about 20 below and a 40-mile-an-hour wind. So the wind chill factor took you down to about minus 70. So in which case, there's no way you're taking your mitts off. So... yes, it really does get colder than... However, the thing about Mars is this. It'll tell you, hey, it's a 60 degrees Fahrenheit on Mars today. Well, that's at the equator, and that's right at ground level. You go 5 feet up, the temperature drops by about 120 degrees.
Whoa.
So, you know, these people think it'd be fun to be a colonist on the surface of Mars. Well, your feet might be warm, but your head won't be. So quite a challenge, but that thin atmosphere, the temperature drops really rapidly as you go even inches up from the surface, yes.
Just trying to get an idea. I know it's an ever-evolving and improving scenario, but what level of certitude do we have regarding the extra solar observations? Of course, the gas giants within a couple of, few billion miles of other stars are easily observed. How much do we know about how much going out? You're saying now we can begin to see belts out there, well, the evidence of belts. Can you speak under that?
Well, when I say we're actually detecting these asteroid and comet belts, obviously we're not seeing the individual asteroids and comets. The stars are much too distant for us to be able to do that. However, for example, the Kuiper belt is dense enough that these asteroids and comets occasionally collide with one another. And when they collide, they produce dust. And it's the dust that we're able to detect. And so by looking at dust around other stars, we get a good picture of what the asteroid and comet belts must look like around those stars.
And are the gas giants out past, let's say, our old Jupiter? Is this discernible?
Well, in terms, I mean, you are right. The easiest planets to discover outside of our solar system are big ones that are orbiting close to their star. But now we've got several different techniques for detecting planets. It's not just the radio velocity method, where we look at the effect that the planet's gravity has on the position of the star. That's the first technique we had for detecting planets outside of our solar system. You now got the Kepler satellite, which is detecting them by transits. Looking at the dimming of the light of the star as a planet passes in front of that star. And that technique allows you to find planets smaller than Venus. So we're now coming up with a statistical database. And also there's a technique where you can use gravitational lensing, where you can use, say, the gravity of a star between you and another star in its planet system to detect planets orbiting stars. We've been able to detect planets in the Andromeda galaxy through the use of what's called microlensing. And then there's techniques whereby you can actually directly see the light of the planet. So we got four different methods for detecting planets, and the bottom line is we're now getting a decent database that is able to tell us what the characteristics of planets would look like if we had a complete population.
Okay.
Now, it'd be nice to have a complete population, and for that we're going to need to discover about 10,000 planets. But we already have a good indication, which is telling us what we see in our solar system, we're not seeing anywhere else. And one reason why we're not seeing it is that we have a unique system of asteroids and comets that we don't see anywhere else. Now, I was going to give you a quote from this paper by Martin and Olivia. They said, quote, "There appears to be a very narrow window of opportunity of time during which the giant planet should form in order for the correct amount of migration to take place, potentially making our solar system even more special." Now, these guys aren't believers, but they're saying that what we're seeing in our solar system is much more fine-tuned than we thought in the past. And they're talking about the planet. They're talking about the planet that manages the development of the asteroids and comets. As I told you earlier, what determines whether or not you get these asteroids and comets is whether or not you got a significantly sized gas giant forming just outside the snow line. And that's the thing about Jupiter. It's 40 to 50 million miles outside of the snow line. And that's the reason why we have asteroids and comets. However, what they're pointing out is if it doesn't migrate at all, and what determines whether or not you get migration is the timing of the forming of the gas giant planet that's just outside the snow line. If it forms after all the asteroids and comets are put in place and everything is settled and the gas giant forms then it doesn't scatter any of the gas asteroids and comets. That's a scenario where you get a huge cloud of asteroids and comets. If the planet, gas giant planet, forms too late. If it forms too early, it will experience significant migration, and that significant migration basically obliterates all the comet and asteroid belts. And if that happens, then you've got no delivery system for bringing gases and liquid water into the rocky planets. Yes.
Is there, the scenario where this gas giant migrates in, is it basically a distribution of mass exercise, like the rotation of a car tire with an imbalance in it, where you move that imbalance where, you know, if you put a weight, you know, if you take the star is rotating, and you put this mass outside, does this mass migrate to a position of balance?
That's a good analogy. I mean, that's kind of what's going on in the theoretical models, is that if you get significant migration taking place, which will happen if the gas giant planet forms at the same time as the formation of the planetesimals. So if it forms at about the same time, you get very aggressive migration, and that migration destabilizes it in the same way it would happen with a tire if you have the weight in the wrong place. You basically can destroy a tire that way. Likewise, in this case, it winds up obliterating all the comets and asteroids. When I say obliterate, two things happen. Many of the asteroids and comets will rush in towards the star and be absorbed by the gravity of the star. But most of them will be scattered out. And so they'll just simply be dissipated to interstellar space. So we anticipate that in interstellar space, we're going to find a lot of junk. A lot of ejected planetesimals from stars when they were forming these gas giant planets. So that's another reason why I have a hard time watching things like Star Trek and Star Wars. You're going through interstellar space, there's a lot of stuff that can damage your spaceship. And what we're now learning is we're going to expect a lot more damaging material to be out there. Yes?
Could that ejected stuff be some of the missing mass that we talk about when we credit to dark energy and dark matter? Is there enough of it to make a difference, do you think?
Well, it would account for what we call some of the missing mass of our galaxy, but only a tiny bit of the missing mass. I mean, there's other sources that are much more predominant, but it does account for some. As I mentioned, it would make interstellar space travel a lot more dangerous than what we thought even a few months ago. Yes?
Periodically, you hear about somebody having a meteor that goes to their house or their car. Does homeowners cover that?
Look at your policy. You can get a policy that will cover that kind of damage. But what you need to look at in your policy is that the section called Acts of God. And see how many acts of God it actually covers. Because a lot of them have a little raw proviso that they will not cover that kind of a thing. So, but yeah, there have actually been people who have been hit bodily by meteorites. So it does happen. But usually it's something relatively small. And a lot of people claim that they've been hit by an asteroid or a comet. Often it's just something ejected from an aircraft that's flying over. So, after all, you know, when the toilets get full, that's what they do. So, that's another image I shouldn't have given you. It's frozen. Don't worry about it. Yeah, people have been hit by that, believe it or not. So, but back to the scenario here. What must be fine-tuned is the location of the formation of Jupiter. It's also important that Jupiter be the dominant gas giant. And notice that's a feature of our solar system. Yes, we got four gas giants, but the one that's the most massive is Jupiter. In fact, Jupiter is more mass than all the rest of the planets combined by about a factor of three. And that's crucial in order to get the asteroid belts as fine-tuned as they are in our solar system. And so if you've got a smaller gas giant there, you've got a problem. It needs to be the biggest of the gas giants. It needs to be just outside the snow line. You want it to migrate a little bit, but not too much. In order to get it to migrate a little bit, it needs to form at the very end of the formation period for the planetesimals and the asteroids and the comets. If it forms after, then nothing happens. And if it forms earlier, too much happens. What you want is for most of the asteroids and comets to be ejected from our solar system and absorbed by the sun, but not all. Now you say, why do we need them? Well, again, that's where our water comes from. That's where our atmosphere comes from. And as I mentioned before, too much is a bad thing. If we get too much water delivery, you'll never get continents. And what's worse, what if you get too much carbon dioxide being delivered? Now you've got an atmosphere that traps too much heat. And even if you got a lot of water, that water will be in a vaporous state. And if it's in a vaporous state, it will dissipate to outer space and be gone. And so we are living on the one rocky planet where we got, you know, sufficient water delivered, where we got enough gravity, and we're far enough away from the sun that the liquid water, while it comes to us in a frozen state, the collision makes it a liquid, but it remains a liquid because we got the right gravitational pull and we're the right distance from the sun where it's not too hot and it's not too cold. Nevertheless, our planet does lose water to outer space. I mean, they got what is called the escape velocity, and so different molecules, different atoms in the atmosphere. If they're lighter, they're going to have a typical higher speed in the atmosphere. So, for example, our planet will not retain helium. Helium is given off as our planet has its uranium and thorium decay. So a lot of helium comes from uranium and thorium decay, but if it gets into the atmosphere, we don't keep it. That helium is too light to be retained by the gravity of a planet Earth. Now, we do not have the gravity to retain methane. Methane has a molecular weight of 16, ammonia 17, water 18. Our planet has enough gravity, as far enough away from the sun, that it can gravitationally retain 18, but not 17 and not 16. Now, most of the methane and ammonia that form in our atmosphere get dissipated by photolysis, by radiation from the sun impacting our atmosphere. But even if that weren't to happen, we would lose it just because we don't have enough gravity. But we do have enough gravity to retain water for a few billion years. If you're talking over hundreds of millions of years or a few billion years, we do lose water. And if we weren't getting ongoing comets colliding with the Earth, we would wind up losing too much water. But the bottom line is this. We got a lot of water delivery when the Earth was really young. And that explains most of the water and most of our atmosphere that we have. But we also get an ongoing supply of water from comets. Every day we get hit by about 10,000 comets. Mini comets, not big ones. And they bring water. And the water they bring balances the water that leaves due to gravitational escape. So we get a little bit of water that leaves. We also get a little bit of water that comes. Bottom line is the water content of planet Earth has been constant over the past 3.5 billion years. Yes?
So I hear these comments about released methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. So it must take a while for the methane to escape.
It does, but it does escape fairly quickly. I mean, what we need to worry about is where you have a big release of methane all at once. Because, you know, it's going to take a few thousand years for that methane to leave the Earth. But if you've got a lot of methane hanging around for a few centuries, you've got a problem. Because it's a very powerful greenhouse gas. Which is one reason why there's a reluctance to exploit clath rates. You say, what are clath rates? It's frozen methane. Methane mixed with water, which stays in a frozen state. I don't know if you've ever actually seen anything on television, but they actually found pieces of clath rate. And here you see this big block of water ice, and they light a match to it, and it burns. So it's kind of, you know, neat to watch this cube of frozen water burning. The reason why it burns is embedded that frozen liquid water is methane. And it's in a gaseous state, but as you light the match to the ice, it makes contact with the methane, ignites the methane, so you've got this big block of ice that's actually burning.
And these clath rates were actually released at one point in Earth's history.
Well, there's lots of mechanisms that produce methane in the Earth, and if that methane makes contact with the surface, it's quickly dissipated to outer space. Mostly through photolysis, but also some through gravitational escape. In order to have clath rate retained, it must be either at a very high pressure or a very low temperature. So where do we find clath rate? We find it in the Arctic and in Antarctica, where it's cold enough that the methane that's released gets trapped in water ice and therefore doesn't get released to the environment. The other place you see it is underneath the ocean floor. And so as methane gets released by biological activity and you get biological material being eroded off the continents in the oceans, as it gets down to the ocean floor where the pressure is high enough, it will trap the methane. But the big concern is this. In terms of fossil fuels, clath rates are probably 99.99% of all the fossil fuel resources we have. So, I mean, if we're running out of coal, oil, and natural gas, clath rate's the place to go. There's all kinds of it. A huge resource. The reason why it's not being exploited is the danger is if you try to get the methane out of those clath rates, it's very easy for that methane just to escape to the atmosphere. So the trick is to get the technology where we could exploit that clath rate, where we can guarantee that the methane won't escape to the atmosphere, and we can somehow keep the methane, say, in a liquid state where we can use it as a fuel. And that technology currently doesn't exist. And although some people think they've got the technology, but thanks, our governments are saying, don't touch the stuff. But here's another reason why people are worried about global warming. If we get significant global warming, it's going to have an impact on what do they call that in the frozen north where they've got permafrost. Yeah, it's the permafrost that traps the clath rates. But if you melt the permafrost, it releases all the methane from the clath rates, and there's huge amounts of trapped clath rates in the Canadian Arctic, Alaska, Siberia, as well as in Antarctica. And if you start melting the permafrost in Canada and Siberia, you could have a gigantic pulse of carbon dioxide go into the atmosphere, which could raise the temperature 20, 30 degrees, not just 1 or 2 degrees. And that would be a catastrophe beyond imagination. It would be the end not only of human civilization, it would be the end of human beings. So there's a big concern. Let's not disturb the permafrost. Yes.
I know there's a well in West Texas where they drilled for gas and found helium because there's a particular salt zone that's pretty unique. I think it's the only well like it in the world. And that's why we think helium's not that rare, is because this well gives the United States the supply. It's why we had blimps in the United States, and the Germans had torches.
Yes.
But where did we get helium before that discovery of that well? And was it really rare as a commodity before that well came up?
Well, it is rare because if it gets into the atmosphere, it just goes straight to outer space. And so there are sources of helium. But, you know, early in the mid-20th century, the primary source of the helium was our nuclear weaponry industry. You know, because by making nuclear weapons, the byproduct is helium. And so they would, get that helium. And I remember as a graduate student at the University of British Columbia that the helium delivery, because, you know, I was involved in a research lab where we were using liquid helium to keep things really cold to do some exotic physics experiments. But it was a secret as to the source of our helium. And so that was part of the national security. They kept hidden the price of the liquid helium and where we were getting the liquid helium, because the concern was the Russians would figure out what we're doing with our nuclear weapons. However, today that's not the primary source of helium. The one you mentioned is a primary source. We got uranium and thorium all throughout the interior of the Earth, and as that uranium and thorium decays, it produces helium as a byproduct. And if there's a structure in the crust of the Earth where that helium is trapped, then you've got an exploitable source of helium. However, you've got to be careful. Helium gets through almost anything. So the only way you're going to have trapped helium is if you've got a very firmly sealed dome in the interior of the Earth. The slightest crack or the slightest porosity, the helium escapes. And so, yeah, we've been fortunate. We've been able to find one of those interior domes where the seal is so good that not much helium gets through.
I hope they crack no over here.
Well, that's the other problem. You have to be very careful how you exploit that helium, because if you drill through the capstone that's trapping that helium, all the helium could quickly dissipate and you've got nothing. And
I think they have one well that they get all that helium from.
Right. Well, it's extremely rare that you're going to have a good enough seal where the helium will be trapped for a significant period of time. I mean, again, as a physics student, I can tell you, trying to keep helium inside a flask is very difficult. And, we were working with liquid helium. The thing about, you could have a little thing of liquid helium like this. The helium actually travels up the rim and down and escapes. And so you got to have it completely sealed to keep the helium in, because it will move up and down anything. Any kind of solid surface, it'll move up and down it. And if it finds a little hole, it'll all go up that little hole. And so, yeah, I remember as a physics student being told, okay, you're going to get a grade at how well you can keep your liquid helium. If you keep it more than 3 hours, we give you an A. If it's gone in 5 minutes, then you don't get a good grade. And so the whole point is you set up your experiment such a way that you basically look for all the leaks. So we'd use some of the gas to see where the leaks are, patch them all up, and then you get the liquid helium in, and the test is how long do you get to keep it. But nobody gets to keep it for a very long period of time. Yes?
The methane that's trapped at the bottom of the ocean, that's generated at the bottom of the ocean, what state is it in? It's not in ice, right, because there's no ice at the bottom of the ocean.
Actually, it is.
Oh.
Okay, because you've got water there, you've got methane there, but because of the extreme pressure, that water and methane gets put into a frozen state.
And the water ice is dense enough to remain down there?
Well, there's two ways you can get water and methane into a frozen state. lower the temperature or raise the pressure. And the Arctic, it's in a frozen state because it's so cold and never gets warm. And underneath the seafloor, the pressures are great enough to keep it in a frozen state. You release the pressure, you no longer have frozen, you no longer have clathrates. Or if you raise the temperature. It's basically a, you know, what you got is a block of frozen water, and trapped in that frozen water are little air pockets of methane. I mean, you know, you get a freezer, for example. I don't know what your refrigerator is like, but when I look at the ice cubes that come out of our refrigerator, it kind of looks kind of foggy. I mean, it's just filled with all kinds of air holes. And you got to pay a premium price to get ice with no air in it. And, you know, a cube of ice with no air in it looks crystal clear. But if you see any, you know, white within it, you know it's got air inside of it. Well, that's kind of what you're looking at with clathrates. You know, it's filled with air, but the air is methane. And because it's under such high pressures and such low temperatures, it's stable. But raise the temperature or lower the pressure, it's no longer stable. And that's the risk. Yeah, question.
I'm following up on your question. You might say, correct me if I'm wrong, you're talking about the buoyancy of water that was raised to the surface. So maybe the water down there, the ice is type 2, type 3, weren't that buoyant.
Well, we're actually talking about clathrates that are underneath the ocean floor.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, if it's above the ocean floor, it's not going to work. The temperature and the pressure is not adequate. So it's just below. So basically what you've got is runoff from the continents of organic material. And as the organic material decays, it produces methane. But as you get this runoff forming a layer above the ocean floor, the pressure is sufficient that that release of methane forms clathrates instead of bubbling up and going to the surface and escaping to outer space. Gee, I didn't think we were going to go this far off the line. We're talking about comets and asteroids. But that's kind of the fun thing about this class. But again, the bottom line is that come Thanksgiving, you really want to thank God for Jupiter. Number one, being the biggest of the gas giant planets, being not too big and not too small, because it could migrate just a little bit, but if it's big, again, it's going to scatter too much of the asteroids and comets out. So it's got just the right size and just the right distance from the sun that it scatters just the right amount of asteroids and comets out. How much does it scatter out? Well, the comet belts that we have today, these five belts, a little bit less than 1% of what we started out with. So 99% of it got removed. And as we're looking at asteroid belts around other stars, they're coming in at 100 to 1,000 times bigger where we see them. But for the vast majority, we don't see anything. The reason we don't see anything is that their gas giant planets have migrated too much. Reason why they migrated too much, they formed too early in the history of the planetary system. But we now have discovered enough gas giant planets to realize that's the norm. Planets typically form early in the history of the star system. Our planets form late, but not too late. Yes?
If you added up all the mass of the material in all the belts, how would it compare to the mass of the planets themselves?
Well, if you were to add all of that up, it still comes in at a little bit less than the mass of the Earth. So, and the Oort cloud has the most. I mean, in terms of how big these are, the Oort cloud is bigger than all the rest of them combined by a large margin. The next biggest one is the Kuiper belt. And then the next biggest ones are the Centaurs and the Scatter belt. The smallest one is the main belt. But hey, that's the enigma. We teach our school children all about the main belt, not about the other ones. And there's not much there. And as I mentioned last week, what's unique about the main belt compared to what we'd expect, even with highly systems similar to ours, our main belt asteroids, most of those main belt asteroids are close to Jupiter and not to Mars. Our models that do predict a main belt tell us you're going to get a large population close to Mars as well as a large population close to Jupiter. But that didn't happen. And why didn't it happen? Those of you who were here last week heard me speak about the jumping Jupiter phenomena. And it's a jumping Jupiter phenomena that clears out the inner main belt. Now that's good, because if you had a big inner main belt, then we'd be getting a lot of nasty hits from rocky asteroids, the stainless steel ones and the carbonaceous ones that when they hit the Earth do a lot of damage. You know, when a comet hits the Earth, a lot of that frozen stuff actually gets melted and evaporated before it actually collides with the Earth. Or we get a lot of water coming in the atmosphere and down to the oceans. But if you got one of these rocky asteroids hitting, and it's bigger than, say, 100 feet across, it's going to do some damage when it hits the Earth. To give you an idea, how many of you ever been to the Winslow Crater in Arizona? Okay? Just a little bit past Phoenix as you go out on, I think it's I-10. Oh, 40. Okay. All right. You go outside 40. You'll see a little town called Winslow, and a couple miles off the freeway, you can see the crater. The crater is a little less than a mile in diameter, and it's 350 feet deep. That was caused by a 100-foot diameter asteroid. So, and you say, how do you get that much damage? Yeah, really, just a little bit bigger than the size of this room did that much damage. And they said it's the equivalent of an atomic bomb in terms of the collision event. And the reason why is it's because of how fast these things are moving. Your typical asteroid or meteorite, when it hits our atmosphere, is hitting at about 100 kilometers per second. And the damage is the mass times the velocity squared. So because it's moving so fast, even though it's not very big, it does a lot of damage. So, as a...
And you see how the flat rocks were warped up at the rim by the force of the blast.
Right. Yeah, so that's not a very big object. And you're going to get something like that. Well, I mean, actually, we had one that size hit Siberia last year. That was also a 100-foot diameter rock. Fortunately, it broke apart in the atmosphere, so it didn't cause as much damage as that one in Arizona. Yes?
It was 100 feet diameter when it hit the Earth, but when it hit our upper atmosphere, was it considerably larger, and it lost a lot of mass because of the...
The thinking is that it pretty well held together as it went through the atmosphere. And so if it's one of these rocky asteroids, especially if it's a stainless steel one, I think in this case it was what they call a rocky asteroid, it basically held together as it went through the atmosphere. Yes, a lot of it burned away as it went through the atmosphere, but when something that's big, most of it gets through.
So the one in Siberia, because it exploded, I would assume it had water in it, it boiled, and it went to sleep, right? And it exploded.
Well, that's the thinking, that it was more cometary than it was asteroidal. And because it's more cometary, as it hit the atmosphere, the heat of going through the atmosphere basically evaporated the frozen water, carbon dioxide, and methane. There was, you know, as I said, it's 80% frozen water, but there's a lot of carbonaceous material. We call it dirty ice. A comet is basically a dirty ice ball. Well, it's the dirt that caused all the damage in that site in Siberia last year. So yeah, most of it was dissipated, but there's still enough rocky material within it that it did significant damage.
So when a comet hits our atmosphere, it's going to vaporize the water, and the water is going to be dispersed in the atmosphere, not as a solid, it'd be more of a vapor.
Some of it gets right through to the surface of the Earth, and some of it gets dissipated in the atmosphere. But again, we got the gravity that a lot of that water actually winds up in our oceans or in our rain clouds. We get to keep it. But again, our planet is not quite big enough to permanently hang on to water. We do lose a small amount over time. You say, why couldn't God just make the planet bigger? If he makes the planet bigger, then you got the problem. You start retaining too much ammonia and methane. You wind up with a thicker atmosphere. And if you've got too thick of an atmosphere, then you can't have lungs. Our lungs require a very highly fine-tuned air pressure. And so if our planet were slightly bigger, we'd be retaining a lot more of our primordial atmosphere, which means lungs couldn't operate. If you have, say, 15 pounds per square inch, If you make it 30 pounds per square inch, then you wind up having great difficulty breathing. Those of you who've done scuba diving realize this. As you go to deep depths, the density of the air goes up, and it's harder to breathe. And if the density goes up by a factor of 3, it will kill you. Factor of 2, it's just difficult for a few hours, but you don't want to stay down there. Likewise, those of you that climb mountains, if you go up a high mountain, the air pressure is too small for lungs to efficiently operate. Literally, we can only go a factor of 3 up or a factor of 3 down, and even if you only go a factor of 50% up or down, it would affect your lifespan. And so it's important. Although people who live at 14,000 feet, you can develop a blood flow that you can adapt to that altitude. But still, sea level is optimal.
Isn't that true with some of the indigenous people that live at higher altitudes? They have their bodies, their chest cavities are actually larger.
They're larger, and they have a much higher iron content in their blood than we do at sea level. And so they're able to pull more oxygen out. But life is more challenging for them. They can't engage in the kinds of activities that we engage in at sea level. And those who go up, say, Mount Everest realize you can only spend a few hours at that altitude without oxygen before you die. And it's because of the air pressure. Our lungs require a very specific air pressure. You say, well, do we have to have lungs? Yeah, you do if you want to be able to attend a class like this. There are other breathing mechanisms, but they will not allow high activity. And we're out of time. Okay, yeah, quickly.
Yeah, just on the lung thing. So if they come back say they live in the Himalayas and they come here, is that hard for them to adapt?
No, they can adapt pretty easily to sea level. It's much harder going the other way because 15 pounds per square inch is ideal. By the way, there is a non-Christian author who wrote a whole book called Nature's Destiny where he talked about the miracle of lungs. And, if you want to have high activity for a long period of time, lungs is the only way to go. But lungs required a very highly fine-tuned atmosphere in terms of the chemistry, the temperature, and the pressure. And we get all that going for us here on planet Earth. But one reason we have all that going for us here on planet Earth, these asteroid belts. So come Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the Centaurs, the Kuiper Belt, the Scattered Belt, etc. Let me bow in prayer. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for what's been happening in the scientific community this past month, where all these papers are now coming out, challenging the conclusion that there's all of this miraculous design we see in our solar system, and recognizing that what we thought was there has actually been grossly underestimated. There's more than what we thought. And Lord, I pray that this observation, that the more we study our solar system, the more evidence we find that your handiwork is responsible for the solar system that we have. Father, that would cause many scientists and non-scientists alike to actually submit to your authority and receive you as Lord and Savior. In Jesus' name, amen.